This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, researchers at Stanford University say they developed a blood test that's able to identify patients at risk for Alzheimer's disease. So far, however, there's little that medicine can do to treat the symptoms of that dreaded disease and no cure. Given that, would you want to know if Alzheimer's lurks in your medical future? My friend Susan Davis had to think about it. Early onset Alzheimer's runs in her family, and given the vagaries of heredity, she may get it or may not. Susan Davis joins us now from the studios of member station WUNC in Durham, North Carolina, where she produces a talk show called The State of Things. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Neil.
And I know that when you heard about this test, you had to be thinking about your dad.
I did. He died of Alzheimer's disease in 1992. He was 58. Very young, and when he died, they weren't sure that there was an absolute genetic link to the disease. His autopsy says that he died of early onset Alzheimer's disease, but in 1992, that simply meant that he was young when he got it.
Yeah. How old was he when he was diagnosed?
He was about 45 when he was diagnosed with dementia.
And how old are you now?
I am 42.
And that makes this a question of some urgency.
It does. And in the time between when he died and when science found genetic links, pretty absolute genetic links, I did something that a lot of people do. I had two children, which means that they're bound to me and to my DNA. So the decision has huge implications for more than just me.
And I know you did some research about that. I know you've done a lot of research about this and other kinds of genetic tests.
I have. We here at North Carolina Public Radio do a series every year called North Carolina Voices. And this year we focused on health and health care. And I spoke to some geneticists that were experts in Alzheimer's, experts in other things. One was a friend of mine. And then I spoke to some people who had been through genetic testing for situations that are, I would say, actionable, meaning the breast cancer gene, where there's a series of tests you can take and also some surgeries, elective surgeries you can do to lessen your chances. And everybody I spoke to had a tremendously compelling story. What convinced me to not get tested for the Alzheimer's mutations were the experts, particularly a geneticist at UNC named Jim Evans, who told me not to, and he was an expert. He said, if you have symptoms, you come see me. But before that, none of us can help you. You can find this out, and I'm still going to tell you, I don't know if you'll get the disease. There was another great researcher at Duke named James Burke, who was also incredibly helpful, who said the same thing, and at some point it was sort of a cacophony of expert voices telling me not to.
Yet if you knew, well, you know you're at risk anyway.
Absolutely.
But if you had more information about it, it's not definitive information.
Right. Well, I can tell you that at this point, there are some experts, geneticists, who believe that early onset might be genetically different from what we call garden variety Alzheimer's disease and simpler. Meaning the indications for that are more clear and that doctors can give you a better idea of what's happening. And maybe I do have two children and they need a future. They need to know sort of if there's going to be a mom and if there's sort of if she's going to be there for them. And then I have a husband who needs to know if he's going to have to take care of me or not and how soon. If any of that information that I could get through genetic testing could help them know some things and help me know some things, I would do it. I'm just waiting for that. And I really think in this experience of doing this research, I really think it's all a matter of coincidence, meaning where your life and your life's journey intersects medicine and research. So I'm hoping that if I'm not lucky and I wind up with this, my kids will be luckier because medicine's moving forward. I know that's true for a lot of breast cancer patients and women who have the breast cancer genes, BRCA1 or 2.
Yeah. But if you knew for sure, would it change the way you lived your life? Would you, spend more time with your kids. You're a poet, too. Would you write more poetry?
I guess I would try. I would like to say so. I would like to say that I would quit everything and we'd, you know, rent an RV and see the world. But I don't know. I mean, shouldn't we all be living our lives that way anyway? I really don't know. That's the other issue. It's very hard to ask this question if you're not prepared for the answer. I think I have to wait until I'm ready to hear absolutely any answer, and I know what I might do.
Yet I'm sure every time you lose your car keys, there's a real stab in your stomach.
Oh, you bet. You bet, particularly because I'm very close to my father's age. I have two older siblings who are past his age. And it's very clear among the three of us what we're looking for. And it's a real specter. It's a real shadow.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Susan Davis produces The State of Things at WUNC and joined us today from that member station in Durham, North Carolina. There's a link to the piece she did about her decision on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We're going to focus on this new Alzheimer's test for a while, but there are other genetic tests, as Susan mentioned, that can tell us whether we're at risk for breast cancer and other kinds of tests that can tell pregnant women if their babies might be born with spina bifida or Down syndrome, just a couple of examples. But as these tests expand and improve, do you want to know? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. If you've made your decision one way or another about getting tested, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, was the Nobel Committee's decision last week really about peace? But anyway, let's get back to genetic testing. We'll begin with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca here in Studio 3A. Joe, nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And tell us a little bit about this new test for Alzheimer's.
Well, it's a blood test, actually, and it's, funnily enough, it's not a genetic test in the sense that it doesn't actually look at your genes. It looks for certain chemicals, proteins that start to appear in the blood. These are messengers between cells, and these scientists figured that if there were some changes going on in the brain, there might be a cascade of differences in the way cells communicated with one another throughout the body, and maybe they could look for just these communication signals, and maybe they would change in a pattern that they could recognize, and they found they could. So this is a test that will tell you whether these physical changes in your body, cellular changes in your body, are taking place, and you don't have to have the symptoms of any kind of disorder. You can simply see that the cells are beginning to behave in a different way.
And is it definitive?
I think that they're saying that it's predictive, highly predictive, because people I haven't looked at the numbers yet. I mean, this is an experiment at this point. They showed that they could say with some accuracy who would get Alzheimer's retrospectively. They looked at people who had mm-hmm. already gotten Alzheimer's and then tried to decide blinded whether they could predict or not. So I don't know whether I don't believe it's 100% predictive. No, that would be very unlikely.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is a new kind of test, but there are other genetic tests that have been around for quite a while.
Right. Well, the difference is, I think, that we would be interested in for the purposes of what we're talking about here is, I mean, in the sense that this would be a diagnostic test. The blood test would tell you, look, you've got Alzheimer's, and we see the early signs of it, because this is something that these changes don't take place until you begin to develop the actual disease.
And it can be some years between the time that begins and when you get diagnosed with dementia.
Right, but presumably it's less years than if you have a genetic predisposition, because if you're a genetic predisposition, you can be tested as an infant and know that in 50 years those factors might come into play. And so that's the big difference here. I mean, one is, you know, that you can see that your blood pressure is going up, and that might be indicative of some disease. But a genetic test, if there were one, mm-hmm. that could tell you that you were prone to hardening of the arteries early in life or high blood pressure or something, that would be something you would know at birth, because you'd have the same genes at birth that you had throughout your life. And that's the kind of long-term consequences that are raised more by genetic testing than some other kinds of medical testing.
Mm-hmm. Also with us here in the studio is Barbara Biesecker. She's a genetic counselor and an investigator at the National Human Genome Research Institute. Good of you to join us today.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
And when it comes to these tests, these are all terrible decisions that people have to make, aren't they?
Some of the decisions are difficult and some are more straightforward. It depends on why a test is being done.
So there are some times when a family has a child who's developmentally delayed or impaired in some way, and they're desperately seeking to understand what's wrong with that child. And they work with medical providers, usually clinical geneticists, to have a genetic test so that they understand better what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And they may see that as a very useful tool and wouldn't question having the test for any reason. I think when we get into predictive testing or screening tests, it gets far more complicated.
And some of those would be?
So in pregnancy now, it's very common for almost all pregnant women who have prenatal care and who have access to physicians to be offered screening. And prenatal screening is a predictive test that tells you the increased likelihood that your baby may be affected with a variety of different conditions like Down syndrome, trisomy 13 or 18, or spina bifida.
Mm-hmm. And some people would fear that this would lead to decisions about, do we have the baby or not?
Right. It first leads to a decision, if it's elevated, about whether or not people want more testing that's more definitive. And that's what's very difficult about screening. It only isolates people who are more likely. It doesn't make a diagnosis. And that causes people a lot of anxiety because they often don't understand that.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, this is where things get. And then there are people who have had, for example, the screening for breast cancer, or women, and feel that they're at high risk and go ahead and have surgery, even if they haven't even developed breast cancer yet.
Right. So that's the kind of genetic testing we call susceptibility testing. And we offer that to people who are at increased risk for carrying a gene mutation that might lead eventually to the development of cancer. And we work with those women to make decisions about whether it would be useful to them, either medically or emotionally or whatever, for them to know that information before they're likely ever to develop cancer.
We're interested to hear from those of you who have had to make these kinds of decisions and taken or not taken these kinds of tests. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. How much do you want to know about what may be lurking in your medical future? I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about your medical future this hour. If you're carrying a gene for breast cancer, for Huntington's disease, or if you're at risk for Alzheimer's, how much do you want to know? Genetic testing is giving us more and more medical options. We want to know what you're choosing. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guests are Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent, and Barbara Biesecker, a genetic counselor and investigator at the National Human Genome Research Institute. Let's get some callers on the line. And we'll begin with Jennifer. Jennifer calling us from Sioux City in Iowa.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I have a son who has type 1 diabetes. He is 10 years old, and we were on our way in the car to see his endocrinologist when we heard the show. I asked my 7-year-old, who does not have type 1, does not have any symptoms of diabetes, if he would want to know ahead of time. And he immediately got really stressed out, started kind of crying and whimpering and saying, I don't want to get my blood sugar. He doesn't want to know, and I don't blame him. I don't think I want to know either. I know there's a test that you can take to find out if your sibling is likely for developing type 1.
And it seems that part of the reason he doesn't want to know is he knows what's involved with it if he does have it.
He does. He sees his brother get his blood sugar checked. He sees him have high blood sugar and low blood sugar, and it's scary. It's scary at age 7 to see that. It's scary at age 10 or 34.
Yeah, and any age whatsoever, believe me. Barbara Biesecker, I wonder if you have any thoughts on this.
I think she brings up a really important point, which is that genetic testing provides information that may be useful to people depending on the context of their lives. And Susan beautifully illustrated that earlier in the show by talking about how she has to have a lot of things come together for her in the context of her life before that information might be useful for.
And in this case, is there anything that Jennifer's son, who doesn't have the symptoms of diabetes at this point, is there anything he'd do to change his life to improve it if indeed he does turn out to have diabetes?
Well, you're asking a great question, which is, can we use this genetic information to prevent disease? But when you're 7 years old, the answer is probably not yet.
Right.
Yeah. Jennifer, it's interesting. Good luck with this.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now. This is Stacy. Stacy with us from Durham, North Carolina.
Hi. Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm well today. Thank you.
I was calling because my take on it, I'm a 43-year-old woman who has two children, one 3 and 1 4 months, and I was kind of required to take the genetic testing for Down syndrome when both my husband and I were, you know, pretty much so we knew the risk, you know, getting pregnant to begin with, and we knew that we had a chance of having a child with Down syndrome, and it didn't matter to us. We were still willing to take that gamble.
Yeah, as an older mother, the risk of Down syndrome goes up, as I understand it.
Exactly. So to me, the genetic testing, yes, it's information, but it's not necessarily, I mean, plenty of people have lived their lives before the genetic testing without that information, and you make your decisions based on what you already know. You know what I mean?
And what decision did you make?
Well, we had the testing done kind of because our doctor said you have to because you're old. but, you know, everything turned out fine for us. But like I said, we already knew that there was a large chance that either of the children could have Down syndrome.
And how did the test turn out?
They were fine. You know, our screening, it doesn't actually tell you whether your child's going to have Down syndrome or not. It tells you percentages-wise whether this child will have Down syndrome or not. And the percentages, you can be on either side.
They can vary, in other words.
Exactly. I mean, it can say your child has a 1 in 350 chance of having Down syndrome. But what if your child is that 350 chance kind of thing where they do have Down syndrome?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it can make you feel a little bit better, but it doesn't, I mean, it's still, you know, it's a luck of the draw kind of thing.
Yeah. Barbara Biesecker, it is, I mean, the information isn't definitive. It's you get
exactly.
The odds, and the odds may be good, and they may not be so good.
That's
exactly
right.
And before the genetic testing, people were still, you know, making the choices of whether they were going to have children late in life or not. So I don't think it really, my opinion is that it doesn't really sway you either way.
If the odds had not been so good, if the odds had been high that your children might have been born with Down syndrome, how would that have changed your thinking?
Well, for me, it wouldn't have changed anything because we decided to get pregnant in the first place, knowing that there would be a chance. And even if we knew that the chance was, you know, really, really great, we still had decided. And even if we had known that you say Mazzy did have Down syndrome, we were still going to have her anyway.
Okay. Barbara?
As a genetic counselor, Stacy, I wanted to ask you something specific. You brought up a really important issue, which is that you felt required to take the test.
Yes.
Most of us in genetics consider prenatal screening to be an optional test and that there should be some amount of consent process that goes on so that you know what might happen. So that, in other words, for people like you and your husband who don't think you would change anything about the pregnancy, you wouldn't go on to have invasive testing like amniocentesis or CBS,
right.
It might be the best decision for you not to have the screening test in the first place. But it gets very, very hard helping healthcare providers feel comfortable not offering tests to people and to have the time in their busy schedules to be able to get consent accomplished.
Hmm. Well, for us, the way it was presented to us was that, you know, you were already at risk. You should know what your risk actually is. And we did have amnio because we felt like, you know, this is what you have to do. This is part of the process of having a baby in America is that you will be tested.
Hmm.
Well, that I have an even stronger reaction to because the decision to undergo invasive testing comes with a risk.
And they told us the risk had gone down a lot recently, that the risk really wasn't as bad as what they were saying when I had my son.
Nevertheless, there's a risk.
Yeah, and you know, but basically I didn't get told specifically, you will have this done, you know, lie down kind of thing, but it was more like, you know, you should really consider having this test done because you know, your baby could have Down syndrome or other genetic problems that you need to know about.
All right.
So it felt uncomfortable, to say the least.
I'm glad it worked out for you, Stacy, and I hope your story will help other women who might be in the same position to inform their decisions, too. Appreciate the phone call, and good luck with your kids.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now. This is Jeff, and Jeff's with us from Yorktown in Virginia.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with maybe another look at risk from a different perspective, and that is once the information is entered in this national medical database, what is the impact on potential future access to health care, insurance, long-term care? I'll take that the answer off the air.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for the phone call. Joe Palka, can you help us out on this?
I could probably run outside and get Julie Rovner or something like that to come in. No, I do know a little bit, and maybe Barb can help fill in a bit, but there have been a lot of fear and a lot of concern and a lot of apprehension about what could happen in this situation because, again, this information may be of personal importance to an individual, but it could be of great financial importance to a corporation that's trying to write policies and use the best underwriting information they have. I don't know that anybody has actually shown that there is something bad going on here. So in the end, the bottom line is, I don't know that there's a problem. It seems as if, just as a reasonable person, you know, thinking about it in a business sense, it would be a concern.
Mm-hmm.
But
sort of the ultimate pre-existing condition.
Right, yeah. Right. And that, some have argued that is the reason, that is the reason we need universal coverage, because if we look hard enough, especially in the genetic arena, we'll find something wrong with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only thing we can say is, look, that's just part of the mix, and we can't use. We have to spread this risk out across the whole population and not make specific decisions based on a given individual.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have universal coverage, so that model breaks down, and then you have to go out into the newsroom and find somebody who understands this stuff better.
Well, Barbara Biesecker, from your point of view.
So this is something genetic counselors talk with their clients about a lot. There's concern that finding out that they're at increased risk, for instance, for developing breast or ovarian cancer is going to be something that their insurance company could discriminate against them for because they could predict that they're at higher risk. But as Joe implied in his statements, many of us have not explicitly seen this happen. What we have seen is we've seen a lot of clients who are concerned about it. We've seen clients base their decision on getting testing on that concern, and that we don't want to see happen. So a lot of people use this as the justification for federal legislation to protect against genetic discrimination.
Mm-hmm. In other words, the legislation would say, even if you knew in advance, this would not affect your access to health coverage, or in fact, could not prevent you from being hired by a company that offered health care for fear that you would drive up their health care costs.
Right.
All right, let's get another caller on the line. This is Alan. Alan's with us from Savannah, Georgia.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Like a previous caller, my wife and I underwent AFP testing on our second daughter, and I can tell you that when the bad result came back from the OBGYN, the 1.5 week wait in order to see the geneticist was the worst time in our life. Luckily, everything turned out to be okay. Most of that test result was driven by the fact that my wife had a very large first child, and even the doctor later admitted that we probably should not have had the test, but going through our mind, not knowing what the genetic result of that test is, and number two, what would we do based on a bad result from the geneticist and the amniocentesis, really does give one pause as to whether they would want to consider any of these other genetic tests. Thanks for your time.
Okay. Thanks, Alan. The AFP test is?
The AFP is one of the prenatal screening tests that is offered to almost all pregnant women now who have access to prenatal care.
And that was what led, in Alan's case, to the subsequent amniocentesis, where a needle is put in and fluid is withdrawn from the womb.
Right. So he implied that actually they didn't take it to that step because it may be that once they heard the woman's history on her first pregnancy, they adjusted the interpretation of the screening result and it resulted in the fact that she wasn't at increased risk. So it may have just been the fact that they had a week and a half of uncertainty, and it raised a lot of very frightening issues for them.
Mm-hmm.
That they needed to discuss.
Let's go now to Frank, and Frank's with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, my wife and I were pregnant a while back, and she has two adult children from a previous marriage that we were all living in the same household, and we had the amniocentesis. And it came back with trisomy 18.
And what's that?
Trisomy 18, Edouard syndrome. It's a severe, very severe developmental disorder.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly, from my experience, I can't understand why people would not want to know, because the decisions we had to make after that didn't just affect my wife and I and the baby. It affected everybody else in the household. And you know, if there's information out there to know, I mean, I'm just the type of person that would want to know it.
Mm-hmm. And what decisions did you make? What was the process like?
considering the survival rate of trisomy 18s, we chose to terminate the pregnancy. Was not a very happy time. Fortunately, I can say that since then we've had a healthy baby girl, and everything's fine. But I couldn't imagine not knowing and knowing what the results of a trisomy 18 birth are. I couldn't imagine not knowing ahead of time.
Barbara?
So I'm very sorry for your loss. I think these are very, very difficult decisions for anyone to make, and not a situation where any of us expect to find ourselves. One of the things genetic counselors are responsible for is to help people be prepared for these things. And I'd like to ask you, because I think it's a very difficult question that we need to understand better. How can we better prepare people at the time you're undergoing a screening test, when the vast majority of those screening test results are going to be normal, and most people are not going to find out that they have a baby with such a diagnosis? It's very hard to engage people around that small likelihood and to get them really thinking what they might want to do. And as a result, when the diagnosis gets made, people are in quite a crisis.
Well, Frank has left us, but we thank him for his call, and again, congratulate him on the birth of his daughter. With us are Barbara Biesecker, you just heard, a genetic counselor and investigator at the National Human Genome Research Institute. Also with us, NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me just follow up on the question you were just asking. These are difficult subjects for people to talk about. It's difficult to make the phone call, much less to answer that kind of question, I think.
Yeah, I think these are very, very difficult and very personal decisions, and it was very brave of him to tell what story they've been through.
Yeah, Joe?
It's not a scientific exploration of the topic, but I'm intrigued that the calls have been from people with children, and these are prenatal testing. And it's interesting to me that I think, is where a lot of people's thoughts and focus are right now. I mean, some of these other tests for adults are a little less familiar, and it's the experience of going through them in childhood and deciding, I think, really grabs people.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get Becky on the line. Becky's with us from Milwaukee.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My mother had Huntington's disease, and she also had a sister and a brother that had it. I had two siblings that died in two separate automobile accidents, and I had another sibling. My other sibling did not want to go through testing because, like Alzheimer's, there is no cure, and it's basically losing function of your brain, a certain function of your brain. And I decided I wanted to go through testing, and I did go through genetic testing because I have two children, because letting them know whether or not I had the gene or not and where they possibly stood as well. I did go through genetic testing, and I was negative. And I know a question was previously brought up if there was relief, yes and no, because the thought was, what about the other sibling who I believe was showing symptoms of Huntington's? He later had committed suicide, which I believe he felt that he definitely had it and was having troubles dealing with that.
Yeah. First, again, we're so sorry for your loss. It's a difficult thing to go through, and I guess, Barbara, you can't understate the stakes involved in people's lives in these kinds of decisions as to whether to get tested and what to do with the information after they receive it.
Yep. Again, I think Becky illustrates how she made a very personal decision for herself, that it was important for her to know as a result of wanting to inform her children at some point whether they were at risk. But not everybody feels that way. And if you look at the research following people at risk for Huntington's disease, the vast majority of them decide not to undergo testing. And those who do undergo testing have been followed in a number of long-term studies, which suggest that people manage that information remarkably well. And our thinking is that the reason for that is because people self-select, that they make good decisions for themselves, and if getting the information is useful, they tend to be the person who goes through the testing.
Hmm. Becky, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And our thanks to our guests, Barbara Biesecker, you just heard from, genetic counselor and investigator at the National Human Genome Research Institute, and NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. They were both with us here in Studio 3A. Coming up, more on Gore. His work on climate change garnered him an Oscar, an Emmy, and now the Nobel Peace Prize. Some, though, debate what climate has to do with peace and say the prize makes a mockery of the award. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.